I'd like to welcome you to the Criminal Sentencing Commission meeting for December 12, 2019. We'll start with roll call. Salvaggio is here. Baker Morsch?
Here.
Boggs? Brown?
Here.
Burns?
Here.
Chambers Smith?
Here.
Chandler?
Here.
DeLamater? DeFranco? Dumb? Eklund? Fregali?
Here.
Gallagher?
Here.
Ebers?
Here.
Ham? Jameson? McElfrish?
Here.
McConville? McIntosh? Miller?
Here.
Montz? Painter? Procki?
Here.
Did I pronounce that right?
Pop Rocky, like Pop Rocks.
Pop Rocky.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Seitz? Stanley?
Here.
Spanigal? Geese? Sims?
Yes.
Thomas? Young? Green? Representative Green?
Here, I'm sorry.
Thank you. We'll do the advisory committee. Adams? Beeler? Berman?
Here.
Cole?
Here.
Chris? Dobson? Lample? Lawrence? Lights? Magura? Mosser?
Here.
McGowan? Moore?
Here.
Pfeiffer?
Here.
Schneider? Spath? Tobin? Williams?
Here.
Wilson?
Here.
And Zamuda?
Present.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
The meeting minutes have been sent out for September. Do I have a motion to approve? Stanley approves. Is there a second? Sims a second. Any discussion? All in favor approving, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, first on the agenda is we had a request from an advisory committee member, Doug Berman, to have an agenda item regarding involuntary manslaughter. And so we have allocated about 15 to 20 minutes. We need to get out of here by 11:45 today. A number of members need to move to other committee meetings, so we want to be respectful of everybody's time. So about 15, 20 minutes, Professor Berman.
Very good, thank you so much. And I want to start by thanking the Vice Chair, the Director, everyone here for giving time to these issues. I also want to thank Lou Tobin of the OPAA for already engaging substantively with the what I'm calling the academics letter that was sent as an open letter to the full commission last month. And I just wanted in these initial comments, and fortunately I talk fast, so that should help, to briefly discuss the background that led to the sending of the letter to the commission, and then also to, as much time as we have, seek input on potential next step for work of academics and perhaps this commission. Start with the background. The other academics on the letter, especially public health scholar Leo Bilecki, have been studying the issue of using homicide charges in accidental overdose cases for the better part of a decade. And Professor Bilecki has been collecting nationwide data, though having to rely on media reports, in large part because there's very little systematic data being collected by government agencies about the use of this kind of charge and the sentences that are resulting. Leo's work through his health and justice lab has been documenting, and he's been quite actively lamenting, that there's been an increase in these charges in recent years. That's perhaps quite unsurprising given nationwide increases in overdose deaths, but as part of what he does and what he's been writing about for quite some time, he believes that drug-induced homicide charges, often they're talked about as DIH charges, drug-induced homicide charges, are rarely, if ever, justified. And I'll read a few sentences from the leading law review article that his lab and the other academics on the letter have been updating that kind of give you just a good summary of the nature of their concerns. many of which I share. These prosecutions often ensnare low-level drug dealers or individuals who do not even fit the characterization of a dealer. Analyses by the Health and Justice Action Lab, that's Professor Valesky's group, the Drug Policy Alliance, a very prominent public policy group, and the New York Times have revealed that a majority of these drug-induced homicide cases do not involve traditional drug dealers, but rather friends, family, and co-users of the overdose decedent. In addition, they go on to say, in cases that do involve commercialized drug distribution, there's a high likelihood of racial bias. The Health and Justice Action Lab's analysis suggests that a disproportionate number of charges are brought in cases where the victim is a non-Hispanic white and the dealer is a person of color. Generally, the lab found that people of color accused of drug-induced homicide or similar crimes receive sentences 2.1 years longer on average than white defendants. Considering that the average sentence length in these cases range from 5 to 10 years, people of color are receiving disproportionately longer sentences. As of October 2019, again, this is his data, nationwide, the median drug-induced homicide sentence for a person of color was 8 years compared to 5 for white defendants, a difference of over 60% over a 10-year period. And so, as a criminal justice expert working here in Ohio, obviously, I've kept up with this research and advocacy, and I've been moved and informed by their arguments for why these prosecutions can be problematic. I was also quite intrigued that Professor Valesky's data, again drawn from media reports, indicated that Ohio was second in the nation for the number of these kinds of prosecutions behind only our neighbor Pennsylvania. At the same time, I've been personally quite frustrated that the data here, not just in Ohio, but you know, all over, is so spotty, and that much of Professor Valesky's work draws on media reports, which can be skewed in a variety of kinds of ways and certainly are not subject to kind of the comprehensiveness that more rigorous data sources would have. Against this backdrop, I was open to exploring this issue more when I was approached in September by a public policy group asking if I was prepared to sign an open letter along with these other academics that was critical of the use of these charges specifically here in Franklin County. I inquired of the group that reached out to me if the goal of the letter was to raise attention to these issues throughout the state. It might make more sense to direct the letter to a body that does statewide work rather than focus on just one county. And I'm big fans of the commission, though, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, I guess, in this setting. And so I also thought, though, and this is again gets back to my concern, that this body would be well positioned to try to draw and work on developing good data to really inform how these charges are being brought, what's behind them, and the resulting sentences. There really is a huge data gap, and it's not just an Ohio data gap, it's nationwide. That all culminated in the letter that you received. And so when I think about next steps, I want to highlight that the center that I run at Ohio State, the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center, has already been doing research work specifically focused on Ohio to try to understand this phenomenon and where it's been and where it's going in the state. I'm glad that my colleagues are here, and I'm eager because one of the big things I want to do is hear from the informed people in this room what more we could be doing, right? That fundamentally, a lot of these issues are subject to research and analysis that this body may not be able to do, may not have the time to do, even if it could. But we exist specifically to hear from stakeholders and try to do academic, independent, objective research that can inform the work of the range of groups that we know care about these issues. I will say, not just the lack of data that's collectively put together, but the concern expressed by Professor Valesky nationwide that the most culpable offenders may not be the ones subject to these homicide charges, that there may be disparities, geographic disparities, other kinds of unwarranted disparities in the way the sentences play out. Those are all issues that I'm concerned about as we start to unpack this more with a focus on Ohio. Again, I said I'm eager for our center to hear from anybody interested about what kind of data gaps we could help fill, but I'm also, you know, eager to talk with the commission about whether this could be a project going forward. I'm especially respectful, the vice chair I think is exactly right, that a part of this issue is how prosecutors use their charging discretion, and that may not properly fit the work of this commission, though obviously it's interrelated to so many sentencing issues and case processing, but you know, part of the feedback I'd like to hear is who is the right body to sort of focus on that. Obviously, it's a concern
from academics nationwide, and it's an ongoing concern with the operation of our justice system, but also the sentencing piece of it is something that we may be uniquely able to look into, and how we should look into it, what particular factors ought to be the focal point for continued study and analysis. Again, that's something that we're just at the starting stage of, and I'm just incredibly grateful, as I said at the outset, to bring this issue to the commission and to get the feedback, you know, whether it's, you know, in our short conversation here or by email, you know, to me or other ways to reach out to me and the folks who work at our center. I find this issue very important and very challenging, and so it's a really all hands on deck kind of endeavor.
In the limited time we have, did you have somebody that also would like to speak with regard to the issue?
I know there are other people here who want to speak. I haven't brought anybody to speak other than that, but I know others have reached out with an interest in expressing their views on the importance of this issue.
All right, thank you. And so to answer your question, yes, there is a group in the back. We have two folks that would like to address the commission. And so the first one looks like it'll be Ashley.
Andrea.
Thank you. And will you let us know where you're from and the organization you represent?
My name is Andrea Rainey. I live in Nelsonville, which is in Athens County, Ohio. I'm a community health worker, and I'm here representing Unharming Ohio. And I'm going to read testimony on behalf of Laura Cash. She could not be here today. My name is Laura Cash. I am on the board of directors of the nonprofit groups GRASP, Grief Recovery After a Substance Passing, and Harm Reduction Ohio. GRASP has a Facebook page of over 10,000 grieving members and over 125 face-to-face grief groups who meet throughout the United States and Canada. I am also a mother whose son, Mark, died unnecessarily of a heroin overdose on June 20th, 2014, after fighting with everything he had to overcome his addiction. Many would assume I am a supporter of drug-induced homicide laws, but nothing could be further from the truth. Let's be very clear, drug-induced homicide laws are not preventing people from dying, but are preventing them from calling 911, which does save lives. Overdose is a preventable tragedy, but it is not murder. Even though the evidence shows that addiction is a chronic, relapsing medical condition, instead of treating it with compassion and understanding, we continue to find more ways to punish and criminalize people who use drugs. Prosecutors are increasingly treating overdose deaths as homicides, but they aren't just going after dealers. Friends, family, and fellow users are going to prison. People who use drugs buy, sell, and share with each other. Even though my family was devastated by my son's death, I never thought about trying to have the person who sold him his fatal dose prosecuted. If he hadn't gotten it from that person, he would have from someone else. He bought a product and knew the risk. Since Mark's death, one of my goals is to help prevent other families from having to deal with their loved one's death. When looking at this issue, I personally consider several factors. First, do drug-induced homicide laws help prevent deaths? Again, the answer is no. These cases do not deter users or dealers. They rarely lead to high-level suppliers. Secondly, I want to help others, not cause harm to another person or family. And lastly, and probably most importantly to me, I think about Mark. Would he want someone to be prosecuted for his death and another family be devastated? I know he would not. If arresting people who use or provide drugs were the answer to prevent deaths, we would not have an overdose problem today. We must open our hearts and minds and employ strategies that will make a difference, not ones that cause harm. It is past time to stop the criminalization and punishment of those who have a substance use disorder. We know what will help save lives. Treating people with dignity and compassion while making these readily accessible and affordable. Naloxone access, syringe exchanges, safe injection sites, and maybe most importantly, medication treatment. I would like to end by sharing a description of my son written by his wife a year after he died. Keep in mind, this wonderful man could have just as easily been charged with drug-induced homicide instead of dying from an overdose. Both destroy lives. We are losing some of the best, brightest, creative, and most loving individuals in our society. It is hard to write about Mark because feeling him was so much better. He was a handsome, charismatic man. I couldn't take my eyes off him. He was a risky man, full of adventure and surprise. He was a loving man. He made sure you knew how much he loved you through his loyalty, time, and words. I miss his company. It didn't take much to enjoy time with Mark. We could enjoy the simplest of things. I miss seeing him with our son. He was so involved and engaged. I miss his logical conversations when I came home ranting after work. I miss how much he loved me, even when I worried that I was just the grossest woman that gained baby weight, smelled after work, or whined too much. He loved me and showed it. I just miss him, all of him. When our son Maxwell was born, I watched this man become a father. He was so maternal and instinct. Whenever Maxwell moved, so did Mark. It's like they were magnetic. I couldn't believe the role that Mark had organically fallen into when Maxwell came into our lives. Mark loved our son so much. You rarely got to see a panoramic view of all his beautiful teeth, but for our son. He was the best man he could be for Maxwell, all smiles. I still to this day wonder if I'll ever be as good of a mom as Mark was a father to our precious child. I feel so privileged to have known Mark and to have been his wife. Thank you for your time and consideration, Laura Cash.
Thank you. Is there a second individual that...
My name is Dan Cahill. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and I'm with Unharming Ohio. I've actually overdosed on fentanyl twice, and lucky for me, the people they weren't intimidated by the consequences of calling 911, because if they had, I wouldn't be here today. I know that there are... Just here in Franklin County, I've seen a lot of overdoses, and a lot of them are coming from rural counties, and they come to Columbus because of the availability of the drugs. But the consequences of the law is actually resulting in more deaths than if people could just simply call 911 without a fear of being prosecuted. I hope the legislators will consider the law and repeal it, and I'm afraid to do something. Thank you.
Thank you. From the commission, any thoughts, comments, questions? Anybody like to say anything? Go ahead.
First off, I hope that everyone had an opportunity to read Lou Tobin's response. He is the director of the executive director of Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. And I think he makes some good points in regards to Professor Burnham's letters, that first off, we're looking at newspaper articles. So that is, in and of itself, very flawed. I don't know how we can say that that is accurate information to slam us prosecutors for going out there and doing our job. Secondly, Mr. Tobin points out, as does Vice Chair, is that prosecutors, we have an ethical duty. We don't go out and charge everybody involved in drug activity. Mr. Tobin sent along some stats involving some of the different counties, some of the concerns that the individuals just spoke about. There is the Good Samaritan law. So those that do call 911, we don't just go out and charge those people for calling 911. Those that overdose the first time, they are automatically permitted and automatically given intervention. That's automatic if you call 911. So it's not that prosecutors and law enforcement go out and arrest and charge everybody involved or who was there during an overdose. That does not happen. We do go out and try and get the suppliers of that drug, and we are not ashamed of that. That is our job. That is the goal of law enforcement, is to get the suppliers of those drugs, not to prosecute those who need the treatment, who want the treatment, and who just happen to be there. So a lot of the things that Executive Director Tobin, I hope that everyone has an opportunity to read his letter thoroughly, because those are good points, those are good statistics, not some article where or letter involving newspapers. So sorry, Professor, but that's, it just offends us prosecutors that all of a sudden, because it's assumed that we're prosecuting everybody involved in overdose deaths, that we're the bad people and that law enforcement is the bad people. That's not what we're doing. If you look at our specialized courts all over Ohio that gives people in diversion, that allows them intervention in lieu 2 and 3 times. You violate once, we don't send you anywhere. We get you into treatment again, because that's what we also want. We don't want to send people to jail for overdoses. That's not what we're about. But we do want to prosecute those who are the suppliers of those drugs causing the overdoses.
Other comments, Sheriff Simmons?
I was making a couple notes. I think most everybody has been in part of the discussion would agree that we would all love to have some central data collection, be able to look at all the data across the criminal justice system, be able to analyze it. And, I mean, that's a huge undertaking, and it's going to cost a lot of money to get everybody on the same page. And I don't know how that would happen, but I think we'd all love to be able to see it. But I did make some notes. I can just talk specifically about our county, which is Warren County, about the availability of services and how this, you know, even the early introduction of somebody that has been arrested or incarcerated during the system. You know, our law enforcement county administers Narcan, and it is, the numbers are off the charts on how many people that have been revived as a result of that. Rarely does that end up in a prosecution position. We have a drug court. We are involved in a Vivitrol program that involves our jail. There is countless treatment opportunities that come out of those two processes. But there has to be a balance in there in the treatment and the accountability. You know, I'm just one person, I don't know where that is, but there has to be a balance. And what happens in Franklin County and how they hold that system and those individuals accountable is going to be a lot different than it is in Warren County, Champaign County, Hocking County. It can't be a one-size-fits-all. And we're all responsible, prosecutors, judges, sheriffs, to the people that live in this county. So where that balance, I don't know what it is, but it seems like the pendulum is starting to swing, that it's handcuffing to some degree what we can do to try to slow down this drug issue coming into our communities. And it can't just be an open opportunity for people to continue to bring these things into these communities. And we do have heart and sympathy and compassion for these people that are going through these stages, but we also have a lack thereof for the people that are bringing this poison into our communities. So, one person, from our perspective.
I had a question for Professor Berman. So the individuals who just presented, I think give a voice to what we all talk about in terms of the drug crisis that's right in the country and our respective communities, because that's the reality. And all the trial judges who are here that serve our community see that on a daily basis. The legislature assisted the courts, I think, in creating new law, the Good Samaritan Law, which provides some measure of safe harbor for those people that will call 911. I'm curious, so my question to you, Professor, is the extent to which the data that you just referred to is pre-Good Samaritan Law data, post-Good Samaritan Law data, or you're not sure?
Yeah, so the data I read from Leo Bolesky and the other academics article about where drug use homicide prosecutions have gone cover a 10-year period. Don't just focus on Ohio. What's interesting is Professor Bolesky and I emailed back and forth. He's running the numbers now, trying to look at those counties that have had more drug-induced homicide prosecutions, whether we see an increase or a decrease in overdoses in those regions relative to other regions. And I know there is some research, it's partially why the General Assembly put forward the Good Samaritan Law, that shows overdose deaths go down when you have these Good Samaritan laws in place. And I think much of the research about drug-induced homicide is kind of what academics perceive as the next stage of that, right? That, and I think part of what prompted it was mentioned in our initial letter, that have Good Samaritan Law, but if people hear about somebody got prosecuted for a homicide in a similar kind of case, they don't believe it's going to protect them, right? And of course, you know, I'm not even and I spent my life doing this, fully informed on what the prosecutors are doing every day, right? And this is where I couldn't agree more. Newspaper reports are very much an incomplete accounting of what's going on. Newspaper reports do capture attention in a kind of way that actual data doesn't for the individuals out there struggling with addiction, using, and all of that, right? And so I don't think it's illogical, let me just put it that way, because the data is still in development. to be worried that these kinds of prosecutions lead people to not think the Good Samaritan law really works, or that they can take comfort in that, because all right, it's one thing to hear there's a new law passed that says you'll be safe if you call 911, but then you hear about somebody over there who got prosecuted for a homicide when the authority showed up and somebody had overdosed and died, right? And again, I would say, I'd be the first one to say, we need a lot more research to see the efficacy of a variety of these kinds of interventions. And I want to be very, very clear, I'm not seeking to assert that prosecutors are bad people or that we're not doing everything possible to find that balance between treatment and accountability. But as the numbers of these prosecutions go up, the question is, are we finding that balance right, right? And again, I think a huge part of what the data that Professor Bielecki has put together is, it's not the story of just the outsiders bringing the drugs into the community. It's a lot of community members and friends and family that are, end up being subject to these charges, though oftentimes there's lots of stories behind that as well, right? And one of the things that I'd love to do, though it's a challenging research to conduct, is, okay, did you not call at the right time for this overdose because you were worried about getting in trouble, right? Again, that's the research that supported the Good Samaritan passage. But right now, we don't have data. I certainly don't have data, but one of the things I think is exactly right that we should be looking at, can we track how effective the Good Samaritan law is proving to be over time, and do we need to worry that these homicide charges undercut that in any way, shape, or form? That are there particular counties or regions where when these types of charges are used more, we get less calls to 911, or we have more problems between reporting problems? So it's a great question, and it's very helpful for us to think about.
Beyond Good Samaritan laws, there are communities in the state that have taken other progressive steps. Lucas County, where I'm from, has a DART program, which is really a deflection program, where the law enforcement agency goes into communities and will literally, with Vivitrol, revive individuals and try to get them into treatment without concern of determining who's committed a crime, who can be charged, and the prosecution of that. That process has won our sheriffs a great deal of recognition and awards, and I think it's appropriate for that. And I believe the current biennium budget, the state saw fit to fund some replica programs of the DART program that we started in Lucas County. So there are other communities are doing similar things, or the notion of deflecting and not necessarily prosecuting, right? So the extent to which you're able to perceive and understand and study non-Good Samaritan, but what are communities grappling with to direct them to treatment, to direct them to saving lives, vis-a-vis determining where did the drugs come from and who should we prosecute.
Senator Thomas.
I guess my thoughts are, if this body is going to make decisions, we want to make those decisions based on what does the data tell us, the empirical data, research, whatever. And when I looked at the number of cases of involuntary manslaughter that was provided by the prosecutor for the counties of Claremont, Cuyahoga, Franklin, Hamilton's estimate, and some of your local counties, that those numbers totaled up to 141 involuntary manslaughter homicides, and then add the estimate of Hamilton County, which was 10 per year for 3 years, about 150 or so, or more. And with that information, it speaks to me that it should not be difficult to take a look at those numbers, examine those cases, and see which ones fit the request of someone who was a drug dealer, who actually did provide the drugs as a dealer, I mean a serious dealer, because we do have those out there. A boyfriend provides the drug to his girlfriend, and they're just supporting their habit. And then one dies and the other one goes to jail. We want to make sure that that's not getting caught up in all of this discussion in terms of involuntary manslaughter. And are we sending some folks to prison that probably should not be going to prison and utilizing resources there? But I do understand the prosecutors, you know, their job is to, you know, do what they do, which is to protect the public and punish those that offend. But it should not be difficult for the legislators, Bill and I, to come up with, let's look at that data. And if you add all the other counties, I'm sure the other counties, the numbers are probably a lot less, because these are much larger counties that we're talking about. And we probably come up with maybe 300, 400, 500, whatever that number might be. That's not a lot of information to look at and determine exactly which one of those do fit into what the prosecutors do. And some may not fit that process.
We have time for a couple more comments, sir.
From a law enforcement side, let me just say, you're talking about people being afraid to call. Many of these that we investigate, that my detectives have investigated, a person's been left somewhere and someone else has found them deceased. So whoever their buddy was or their friend was or their relative was that may have been with them while they were using, they left them there anyway. We have a person sitting in federal custody right now that we tracked back that was an actual dealer that had AR-15s and everything else in their residence. Okay, and I talked with Representative Boggs before. We talked about where the drugs and the weapons mix, where when we start giving people too many breaks, you know, we're trying to take care of guns over here, but a lot of times guns go with drugs. So we really have to weigh out who are we giving breaks to and who are we not giving breaks to. And I'm sorry, but even inadvertently by drug use, if you're providing that drug and you cost someone their life, there has to be some accountability there. There just has to be. We're talking about human life. And we're one of the leading overdose states in the country. You know, we're not trying to victimize people who are drug users. We're trying to find justice for people who had their lives taken. And just the whole way this thing's written up, it seems like prosecutors and law enforcement are the bad guy because we're picking on drug users. We're investigating the loss of a human life. That's the underlying thing.
One more time.
I think the question is that we don't get, either side doesn't get defensive about what's going on. I think what we really, what Professor Berman is asking this commission to do is to collect data, because the things that are available now are nothing but newspaper articles. And I think that part of our job is to collect data, to analyze that data so that we end up with an evidence-based system and we're not just out there doing things that we don't know if they're going to work. So I think that's what our commission needs to decide. Is this something that we want to get involved in to collect that data or to help collect that data?
Prosecutor Warren.
I've always been a fan of a better data collection system within the state. We have a very fractured system. However, I don't think because we have a fractured system, we should pick a specific topic and collect data for that topic, hoping to find a specific answer. I don't think that gives us the answer that we're seeking. And I think by already narrowing the question and limiting it to a specific piece of data, we're already going to basically be targeting the answer that we think we want to find. I think that the state, and we hear this again and again, and this is a common theme for the Sentencing Commission, we are just simply lacking data, period. And to the extent that we're talking about a statewide system for collectively gathering conviction data and charging data and all of those things that prosecutors could use for better record checks, that law enforcement could use for better research and investigation, I'd be supportive of that. But I'm very concerned about just picking a topic. And involuntary manslaughter is a lot broader than what we're just talking about as well. I mean, involuntary manslaughter covers a whole range of criteria and offenses. And the opposite way, you might have individuals who are charged related to an overdose death that are not charged with involuntary manslaughter. So by just saying we're going to pick involuntary manslaughter that comes from an overdose death, I don't think we get data that's going to be useful.
Probably the hardest thing that a judge or a prosecutor or even a defense attorney has to do is deal with a case that has unintended consequences. And whether it's a drug overdose death or an OBI case that turns into aggravated vehicular assault or aggravated vehicular homicide, when you go into a courtroom and you see victims' families hugging defendants' families, and you see great emotion, and you as a sentencing judge or a prosecutor have this unsettling feeling because you know nobody in the courtroom intended this for this to happen. It makes it very difficult, and there's no question about it. But we have to remember a couple of things. Number one, the legislature has given prosecutors some tools to gauge conduct. Number two, prosecutors have an ethical duty to make sure that their charging decisions are supported by evidence. Number three, the legislature has given judges the responsibility to make sure that not only do we consider the serious factors, but the less serious factors. Did the victim induce the offense? Is there mitigation evidence that, although not a defense, mitigates the defendant's behavior? We're supposed to look at criminal history record. We're supposed to look at the offender's alcohol and drug history. If a person does get sentenced to prison, we have a number of early release mechanisms. We have different levels of treatment. And so for us to collectively to come in and, number one, classify involuntary manslaughter as a murder offense, it's not murder, it's involuntary manslaughter, meaning there was an unintended consequence. And I understand on both sides that we don't want to seem defensive. But let's remember that the legislature has given us some tools to use, and it's just a matter of using those tools. And there are some cases where those tools don't fit, and out of that we have public policy decisions that are made that really cause more problems than was set out. If there's a motion on the floor, we'll entertain a motion. Otherwise, it's time for us to move on. There's been a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Chief, what is the scope of the data collection? Will it also, what I think you might be interested in, back to Dan in the back for sharing his personal story, I think it would be also important to recognize how many second offense forms exist in counties, and then those who did use the Good Samaritan law, how many of those folks ended up to become victims themselves? Meaning, I think if we're going to look at the data of involuntary manslaughter offenses, the facts around those, it would be also interesting while we're collecting data of the process that had been put in place to protect overdose addicts sometimes has also worked against, and we end up losing more lives because those folks have been given a prosecutorial break where they're not being charged as long as they seek treatment, only to unfortunately overdose and pass away.
I think there's a lot, and I don't know how we narrow it or what the scope is going to be. I think that would be something that Dr. Bloom or Professor Bloom would have to help us with. But we've come a long way from the point where, you know, we sat in here and didn't believe that we should have treatment, and we were, you know, everybody was getting charged and going in for 9 months, coming back out and getting charged again. So we need to collect the data. We need to get the case.
Well, but we should also not have just an open-ended check. I mean, we need to be specific in what we're asking for. Maybe you could work with Professor Berman and come in with a more specific motion for next meeting. Paul?
I'm not sure what you're intending with your motion. If you're intending to have Dr. Berman's group do the study, then I would strongly recommend this group not take that kind of position because he's already indicated a point of view which just divides this group. If you want Sarah's staff to study something, that's a neutral. But you're not talking about having a neutral do the study. And this group struggles enough to be taken seriously in terms of the recommendations. And handing that off to Professor Berman, I think just divides this group listening to this discussion. I don't think you want to do that.
That wasn't my intention to hand it off to Professor Berman, but I think that I was thinking that Sarah's staff in this commission would be doing that, but I think that we need to outline what, in more detail, what we're looking for.
Carlton?
Okay.
Well, we're happy to help on this specific issue and to work with Sarah's staff and to provide some resources for that. But I do think that this just highlights, and we're happy to focus on this specific issue for this purpose, but I think this highlights, again, an overwhelming problem that we have here is that we have to piecemeal data too often. And so many times we're trying to, whether it's problem identification, resource allocation, developing some type of response, where we're forced to go county to county, jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do. So I really think we will utilize resources to look at this specific problem, but we really need to get serious about collecting data and trying to find some way to make data more available throughout the state and to collect it in a usable way that people can use it to make decisions that we need to make, because it is hard enough to address a problem when you know exactly what the problem looks like. It's impossible when you don't.
So if I may, Paula, would you be willing to amend your motion to suggest that OCJS and the commission work together to see if there's a researched way to look into it and report back to this group at its next meeting? And I forget who seconded. Senator Thomas? Second.
Any more discussion?
Carlton's exactly correct. Simply because I was concerned that we don't even collect the data from the county. It's still relatively messy. That's the problem with that. It's nothing, that's not a difficult task. So, yes, I agree with you.
All right, we'll call for the, yes, Sheriff.
I'm sorry to belabor this. I'm all about the data collection. I think it's very important, but I just wanted to make a couple comments that it can be concerning in my view about what the data may not show, depending upon how it's collected. There was a mention about outsiders versus community dealers. Well, unfortunately, those dealers oftentimes are community dealers. You know, so it's not always outside dealers. So how that gets interpreted, I don't know. The other thing that the data won't show, I've spent time having conversations with those addicted in our jail that won't show. The individuals that don't want to have that choose to go to prison over their treatment programs because they can get out in a very short order and have no accountability. You're not going to see that. You're going to see somebody going to prison, and you're going to try to decide whether that person should or should not have gone to prison. A lot of times it's by their own choosing. I know that our local judges have had people in front of them that have been offered the ILC. They refuse. You may not see that in the data collection. How that gets interpreted, again, I don't know. And then the last comment, just we talked about Senator Thomas reference to the boyfriend-girlfriend supplier and girlfriend dies, etc. Well, here's the thing. We don't know anything about that boyfriend's history. He could have been a repeated offender. So to give a blanket rule or blanket decision to that person continuing treatment can be misinterpreted also in this, in that. So there's some concerns, in my humble opinion, of just driving what the criminal justice system collects and then making some shotgun decision about how we're going to shift, you know, the decision making on the local level.
All right. The motion is for the commission to pursue some data-driven analysis. I suggest that we do a roll call vote.
And may I qualify that? In partnership with OCJS and the viability, the feasibility is doing something. I'm not convinced that we can, but I think we should explore it. So I don't want to overcommit here.
It's not that we're going to do it. It's that CJS and Sarah are going to report to us in the future on
if there's
whether
a way.
It can be done, and if so, make recommendations on how to do it.
Yes.
All right.
Which I think gets to your point and Justice Piper's point and the other points, which is, you know, we need it to be done in a neutral fashion. We need to drill down very specifically as to what we're looking for. I'm not going to support something that requires the prosecutors to go back 10 years and tell us every involuntary manslaughter case they ever had. You know, but we'll leave that to Carlton and Sarah to ponder.
All right.
Okay.
All of you.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Can we do a show again?
No.
All right, so Savaggio?
No.
Lara?
No.
Representative Boggs?
So point of clarity, this is to request research where the terms of the research is going to be determined by the people who are ultimately going to be researching this information.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, Carlson and I are going to get together and determine if it's feasible to even look into this. How would we do it? Is it possible? And then report back to this group. So nothing is actually going to be done other than can we do it and how would we do it? You guys need to tell us if you want us to do it.
Okay, then yes.
Paula?
Yes.
Brooke?
Yes.
Kyle?
Yes.
Chief Chandler?
No.
Judge Delamater?
No.
Judge Fregali?
No.
Judge Gallagher?
Yes.
Gwen?
No.
Kathleen?
Yes.
Judge McElfresh?
No.
Kevin?
Yes.
Liz?
No.
Representative Seitz?
Yes.
Chief Stanley?
No.
Amy? Mariah?
All the same.
Sheriff Sims?
No.
Senator Thomas?
Yes.
Does the commission issue an advisory commission?
I don't know. We have a cut.
Chair's not here tonight.
So it's
tied, so. All right. Next on our agenda. Next on the agenda, we have guests here to speak about appellate review and the impact of the Gwynn decision. We've got from the 8th District Court of Appeals, Commission Member Sean Gallagher. We've got from the 11th District Court of Appeals, Cynthia Rice. And we've got from the 6th District Court of Appeals, Gene Stewart. Whoever wants.
I'll go first because you know I've been on this crusade for about 20 years to try to reform sentencing in Ohio, and I've been unsuccessful. But for those of you that are not familiar with State v. Gwynn, it's an Ohio Supreme Court decision that was released on November 21st, and it dealt with felony sentencing review in Ohio. Ohio has a statute, 295308, which is the vehicle by which appellate judges are tasked with reviewing trial court sentences at the felony level.
Sean, can I interrupt you? Sure. I meant to introduce, and it's my fault. We have our administrative director from the Supreme Court who recently came on board in August, Jeff Hagler. And it's my fault I didn't introduce him in the first go around, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but if I didn't, I would forget him. So, Jeff, thank you very much for coming to the commission meeting.
Thank you very much, Judge. And I am coming back to Ohio after having been in the Army for 29 years, so it's very good to be back. I look forward to working with all of you all and seeing what the Supreme Court can do to support your efforts. So, thanks, I look forward to meeting you.
I went back and recounted. It was actually 10 no's and 9 yeses. The vote did not pass. So I apologize. That was my fault for can't read my hash marks.
Okay, so it took out.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. So today there are roughly 50,000 inmates in Ohio's prisons, give or take a few. And I like to always sense that in a comparative status. And so I thought about it. I said, gee, I looked at a list, that's the populations of the city of Newark, Ohio, roughly Lakewood, Ohio, roughly Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. So if you're familiar with any of those communities, if you can imagine that everybody that lives within that community, man, woman, and child, is in prison in Ohio. That's one way of looking at it. Now, listen, I'm a former prosecutor. A lot of those people belong in prison. I get it, but I'm always concerned, are we maximizing our resources and are we being smart about who we're sentencing to jail? So very quickly, because I know time is of the essence, the Gwynn case, for those of you that are not familiar with it, involved a somewhat aged woman by criminal justice standards in her 50s or early 60s that committed a series of thefts at nursing homes involving elderly patients. She was initially sentenced by the trial court to 65 years in prison, and these counts were all run consecutively. On appeal, the Fifth District Court of Appeals reversed that 65-year sentence and imposed a 15-year sentence using 295308. But they read in some provisions into 295308, which are frankly not there. And the Supreme Court reversed the Fifth District Court of Appeals and remanded the case back to the trial court. So I've sent around questionnaires to a lot of judges in Ohio asking about what do you think about the status of the Gwynn decision? Do we really have any felony sentencing review in Ohio anymore in light of it and given the problematic language in 295308? And I've included a couple of, I think, the ones that are that fit the most capture the essence of what I've been told by others, and they're up there on the counter if anybody wants to look at them. I redacted the names at the writer's request so that they would not feel compelled. So real fast, on Thanksgiving, it was my 64th birthday. So my 23-year-old son, who I didn't think really had a sense of rock music history, started singing to me the Beatles, When I'm 64. And I said, gee, I raised a pretty insightful kid. And but in that song, there's a line, will you still feed me, will you still need me when I'm 64? And I just frankly think that ODRC is going to be feeding, whether they need them, they will be feeding them when they're 64. And that may be what we want in Ohio, and that's fine. I really don't have a dog in this fight. But I just think that we get these sentences, and right now felony sentencing review is this. I take the file, I hold it up to my nose, and I sniff it. If it smells and my colleagues think it smells, it might get reversed. And if it doesn't smell, it doesn't get reversed. But that's a hell of a way to run a railroad. So that's about all I really have. I think we either have to consider doing nothing. That's a consideration. Just keep on going. But I think with SB 201, we're going to see indefinite sentences. The numbers are going to rise. You don't have to be a math major to know that. And if you don't really have an effective review of these longer sentences, you're going to get a prison population that's going to be at 60,000 before you know it. And it's going to happen. We're starting to see the first things with SB 201. So I suggest three possibilities. We can cap consecutive sentencing. We can go back and put the Foster fixes back into the sentencing review process, although that's problematic too with things like worst form of the offender or similarly situated offenders. There's million. Or we can go back to pre-SB2, which was put him in prison and let the parole board figure it out. So with that, I'll turn it over to either Judge Zamuda or Judge Rice.
Well, I would just reiterate what Judge Gallagher has said. We're frustrated in the Court of Appeals in that we're getting a multitude of cases that we're asked to review, and yet our standard review is so limited that we really can't give it meaningful review. And you smell it as the Gwynn court smelled that Gwynn smelled, and yet they were reversed. So we really don't have a system to meaningfully review these cases, and we either need to stop asking the Court of Appeals to review these cases or recognize the frustration and find a way to make it more amenable to review. I've worked in the criminal justice system as a prosecutor before and after Senate Bill 2. I've seen review when it was abuse of discretion, don't worry about it, you know, they can do that, to where we have had multiple reviews by the Court of Appeals for lack of making findings and cases that are reversed. Post-Foster, that's been removed from us. We really don't have much to look at, so we can either revise it and look at what we could fix to go back pre-Foster and make it work in compliance with Apprendi and Blakely, or we gotta do something, but otherwise we really do not have a way to review these cases.
I have about 4 points, and I think let's take a step back and understand that whatever appellate review exists in Ohio is because the legislature has granted that authority to make appointments. All right? So what we're doing now is a consequence of the law passed previously by the legislature. The current iteration started in 1996 with the passage of SB 2. And really, I think what Gwynn highlights for me is a disconnect as a consequence of two simple facts. Number one, trial court judges are required to sentence per convicted count. So if a prosecutor is able to prosecute a defendant on 20 counts, each count must have its own sentence. What a court can't do is they can't say, this defendant for this case shall be sentenced to X, but rather each offense for which there is a conviction must be sentenced. So Ms. Gwynn suffers the ignominy of a 65-year sentence as a consequence of simple math. They're all low-level felonies. But because of the number of felonies for which she was convicted, running them consecutive gets her to the 65 years, which is what the judge felt was appropriate. Secondly, the current iteration of law makes no consideration at all. There's nothing of all the criteria that are set forth and the mechanism by which appellate judges can review or trial judges can impose a sentence, there's no consideration for looking at a sentence, as I call it, holistically. If you look at the Fifth District's decision, I think that's ultimately what they really did. They looked at it and they said, you know what? As Sean pointed out, that smell test, 65 is just a little too much, given the facts as we know in this case. And they've tried to figure out a way to reduce that, because there is a mechanism, as you all know, in the statute to allow appellate courts to review it. So I think the charge here is, in light of when, what does the state of Ohio want to do? I know trial court judges do not want to give the appellate courts carte blanche review of their sentences. Good God, as somebody pointed out, that would be the Wild West. I don't even think the appellate courts want that, all right? But the reality is that I think the legislature needs to look at why can't we see, how do we craft some limiting legislation that would allow a consideration, not just per count, but for the case in its entirety. Because sometimes, I mean, the thing about Ms. Gwynn, the reason she had so many counts, her offenses occurred over an 8-year period. Worked in a nursing home, was able to obtain information about where individuals from that nursing home were located, went and stole items. And she did it over a long period of time, for which the prosecutor felt an obligation, given the victims in those cases, say they want prosecution, and that's what happened. And the judge was forced to impose a sentence. So I think we have an opportunity. And so I would add a fourth criteria, Sean, and that is to look at creating a separate exception that specifically addresses head-on this issue cumulative sentence, not just consecutive, because even with the consecutive, you're still considering individual ones, but rather the sentence of the case as a whole, because the case is what defendants are ultimately sentenced to. It's the case that comes before the appellate court. It's not an individual offense. The other point I wanted to make is Gwen has a companion case, and that's Jones, State v. Jones, all right? And before I get to State v. Jones, I will say, I think if you, and then I don't want to get too much into the weeds as judges and lawyers, but when you look at the votes, all right, there are three justices that comprise the majority decision. The decision was authored by Justice Stewart, and Chief Justice, our Chief Justice, Maureen O'Connor, concurred in that, as did Justice French. Justice Kennedy and Justice DeWine, Justice Kennedy wrote a separate concurrence, which I'm curious why it ultimately is denominated concurrence, because I think the only thing she actually concurred in is the remanding back to the appellate court. I don't think she concurred in why it's going back to the appellate court. In fact, I think she specifically found exception to this. I think she dissented on that. But it's denominated as a concurrence, and then Justice DeWine concurred in that concurrence. Interestingly enough, Justice Fisher did not write a separate opinion, did not join in either the concurring, either the majority or concurring opinion. He just concurred in the judgment without comment. So he's an outlier, so to speak, because we don't know what he's thinking, right? And then, of course, there's the dissenting justice, Donnelly, who said it was wrong. What does that all mean? And I think practically you have to look at it this way. There's really three justices that are on record in supporting the holding of Gwen. There's a majority of justices that aren't really comfortable with the holding of Gwen for the reasons stated both in the dissent, in the concurring opinion, and the fact that there isn't an opinion of one justice, all right? That for all of us, okay, the judges and lawyers, means I think that there's a limiting impact that Gwen will have until there's more clarification. Which gets me to Jones. Because Gwen and Jones is another, I think they denominate it as a companion case. It certainly is related. And it's a case out of the 8th District. And
I wrote the dissent.
You wrote a hell of a dissent, John. And I would encourage, if you have some 20 minutes or so, to read his dissent. But it actually tees up the issue that we're talking about, I think, more directly than Gwen did. And that case has been stayed by the Supreme Court pending the decision and outcome of Gwen. Now that Gwen's decided, the Supreme Court has to now reactivate that. I'm not sure what they're going to do, but given the question posed, I would expect it would just be briefed and argued. And what's interesting about that is I don't think Justice Stewart will be able to sit, right? Because she wrote a concurring opinion in the Jones decision, which gave the majority. I mean, she actually was the majority decision. Think about it. She gave the majority to the majority decision with her concurrence, but because she rendered that decision, I believe, by operational law, she can't sit on the Supreme Court when Jones is heard. So if you have Justice Stewart deciding Gwen, but not going to be able to have impact or opine as it relates to Jones. And I think Jones will really provide clarity, I hope, right?
If they what get do you think? I don't think they'll get the four votes.
Well, maybe they could.
If they do, but.
So the and then my fourth point is, and that's Hairston, okay? Because one of the ways that you could go about and look at the holistic and say, wait a minute, it's just an excessive sentence given all the facts of this case, was really looked at by Hairston in your case. Well, I mean, you wrote about it, it's not your case, but in Hairston, somebody was sentenced to 134 years in prison. Okay, had multiple offenses. Justice, were you involved in Hairston? The Supreme Court upheld that sentence. The challenge on that sentence concerned whether or not it violated the U.S. Constitution, 8th Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. And that was the only real issue that they decided. And they said no. And they said no because sentencing is per count, per offense, not per case. So if Hairston remains the law of the land in Ohio, you'll never be able to use a violation of the 8th Amendment as a means to challenge any perceived excessive sentence case. So the other approach is if prosecutors and or defense counsel try to get a rehearing relative to Harrison, that would be another one to think about. I don't know what's going to happen. So that's sort of my thoughts on where we are, where we've been, and potential avenues to where we could go.
Questions?
No. Crickets are good, you know.
Does the commission want to consider
past?
Yeah, please.
I mean, does the commission really want to? The commission should give direction, part of our charge, I think, as a commission. In what direction do we want courts to operate? What do we want to give in terms of what appellate courts should be doing? Do we want them to consider the whole sentence, irrespective of the individual sentence per offense? Do we want to separately categorize that as a mechanism or a vehicle by which an appeal could be taken? If that's decided as a policy for the state, the commission can look into that to make a recommendation, and the legislature could take that up and amend OACT. They could say, no, we don't want to, we're going to live. But until that issue is confronted, you're always going to have this disconnect between individual count sentences and the simple math consequence of that in a multi-count, which represents a...
Well, I'm speaking for myself. I would hope that the commission would give us some guidance in the legislature about what to do. We already had the recodification committee give us guidance, and I thought that guidance was good, but it was difficult because part of their recommendation involved the appellate court's ability to look at the sentence as far as whether it was proportionate to other sentences for the same offense elsewhere in the state. And apparently we don't have the data to know what the sentences are all around the state to make an educated determination as to whether a given sentence is proportional. So I think that was a problem with what the recodification committee's recommended. But I, for one, would certainly be all in favor of allowing what you said to happen and allowing what Judge Gallagher said to happen. I mean, and frankly, if we don't give the appellate courts the power to do that, there's nobody else that can do it, because now there's a decision out of Hamilton County, my dear friend Judge Heekin, that I think is wrong, by the way, but nonetheless he concluded that the Reagan-Tokes Act, which allowed for indefinite sentences, which could be knocked down by the parole board if the parole board wanted to, was somehow an unfair delegation to the parole board of otherwise judicial powers, okay? So, you know, I think that's wrong, because unlike the previous decision, which involved just the parole board being able to do bad time or good time, this time the parole board is operating within the parameters of a judicially established sentence. That's my take on why I think my dear friend Judge Heekin was wrong, but I guess we'll find out. And I really do think this commission and the people on this commission have an obligation to the state of Ohio to help us control against going from 50,000 people to 60,000 people in a prison system built for 38,000 people, okay? I mean, that's just the fact, okay? And so if this commission is gonna do anything, that would be a damn good thing for it to do, because otherwise it just looks like a big debating society that can't even agree on whether we should collect data or not, which is...
and that's the problem that I think as legislators, we got to recognize that in order for the commission to do their work effectively, we got to create the resources for that data, whatever that's going to look like, whatever the cost is going to be to put it on together. We got to do that as legislators. Or we just spinning our wheels and we're not getting anywhere. Because everything seems to go back to that. What does the data say?
Well, but Senator, what Judge Zabuda and Judge Gallagher are saying really would not require data. It would empower appellate courts to make determinations that this Quinn case suggests they do not now have the power to make, okay? And you know, review of some sort of a cap on the number of consecutive sentences, that would be a great idea, if you ask me, at least for lower level felons. And I'm not gonna predetermine what your recommendation is, but you know, apparently this nurse was stealing grandma's tchotchkes over a period of 8 years, where they were F4s or 5, weren't they?
Yeah, right. There was nothing higher than an F3, and the longest individual sentence she received was 3 years.
Yeah, but when you tack, you know, them all together, 65 years, I mean, it's not nice to steal from grandma over 8 years. No, that's not nice, but then you just stack it together, 65 years, that's kind of ridiculous, if you ask me. And you either have to have the power to review the whole sentence holistically, and or the power to say, we think this is too many consecutive sentences, at least for lower level felons.
You know, I'm sorry.
Now, I was just gonna say, relate to all this, what the common theme is here is if you have the ability to challenge an individual sentence under the Eighth Amendment if for cruel and unusual, right? And you have, under the existing code, the ability to consecutive sentences. Isn't the answer just as simple as saying that if you choose to consecutive sentences, that's appealable?
Well, it is appealable. 29, 29, 29.
Right.
It is, but the review is so deferential.
Rather than talking about cumulative, then you're getting into murky kind of areas. I'm saying, let's just make this a simple.
Well, the legislature would have to invalidate State v. Saxon. Mm-hmm. When the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court decided State v. Saxon, and Justice Pfeiffer dissented in that case. Saxon was a case decided almost 20 years ago, right, Justice? And it's been the law of Ohio for trial judges and appellate judges, and that's what Judge Zamuda was talking about. Individual charge, individual sentence, individual review. And, you know, we don't look at this collectively. So, look, Senator Sykes, we commonly laugh, it's a sad laugh, but it's a true laugh, and the Court of Appeals will say, gee, if only the defendant had killed somebody, they would have only gotten 20 to life. But instead, you know, like in Harrison, they got 138 years. You know, I mean, all I'm saying is, look, there are bad people out there that need to be in prison. But we ought to be smart about what we're doing. You know, we got so many jail spaces. Let's put the bad guys in jail or the bad women in jail, and let's work around everything else. Give us some kind of a system to do that. It could be caps. It could be a stricter review, whatever. I mean, make trial judges do, you know, Nick, I know your colleagues don't want to hear that, right? They don't want to be told that they want unbridled discretion. I get that.
If I could interrupt you, having lived through this 10 years ago, I know the trial judges did not like whatever the law was then that made them write all these findings down and have to write an essay. And that's why we tried to correct for some of that in House Bill 86,
sure,
as I recall, okay? So I'm on your side up until that point, because I know all the common pleas judges would revolt if they had to.
Yeah, and I know they would too.
Right. Okay, so
but that's why I say there are other means to limit that, either caps or coming up with something else.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
But shifting the burden back to the common pleas judges, they have to do what they objected to.
There won't be any Nick Salvaggio opinions there.
Well, I tend to be probably an outlier. I write findings in my sentencing entries because if anybody wants to find out, well, why did this judge do whatever he did, man, it's right there. I put reasons. I understand my colleagues don't like to do that. I do just because I want people to know how I think and that kind of stuff. All that being said, I think part of the problem is that if the appellate courts want to review a judge's decision in a way that is opposite from what the judge was able to do to begin with, this goes back to Saxon, you know, it's hard to look at the cumulative nature of a case from an appellate point of view when the judge is sentencing it on an individual basis. So to me, the answer would be that have the legislature address Saxon, and then that way we're comparing apples to apples. Because the way we're doing it now is the appellate courts are looking at it as oranges and judges are sentencing it as apples, and that's why we've got this disconnect.
And at least looking at the underlying
and you guys have heard me say this in regard to Adelphi before, Saxon's majority opinion, which was actually written by the chief, the underlying sort of basis for that distinction that you were sentenced on one count and one count only is that at that time under Ohio law, one count's sentence couldn't affect another count, so you could handle each one individually without bothering any of the rest of the charges they were sentenced on. That is no longer the case. The legislature has addressed that by passing the Reagan-Tokes Act, which now a problem in one sentence can affect a sentence in the entire case. If one count is stricken, is void or voidable, that was the basis for determining the maximum term, now you've got a problem with the whole case that needs to be resentenced. So if
it's letting out a little lesson from the experience, which is not a perfect one, but maybe useful in this context of the federal system, where over the last 15 years after Booker, appellate courts are reviewing the district judge's sentences for reasonableness, there's been lots of complaints, academics like to complain, that, boy, very few sentences are getting reversed for substantive reasonableness, meaning the appellate court telling the district court, you got it wrong, on the merits of how long a sentence you gave. But a decent number of sentences are reversed on what's often called procedural reasonableness, which is often in the terms of, you didn't explain well enough why you gave this particular sentence. Now, often that's in reference to the guidelines in the federal system, and so, the thought to throw out, and again, it may not function well in this setting, if there was a mechanism for the appellate courts, especially in these consecutive sentences cases, to say, not, we think that's wrong, but just, if you're going to stack all these sentences, you need to give an on-the-record explanation, I would say the Slovakia method, right, is necessary in these kinds of cases. Now, I see appellate courts here shaking their head, no, we never want to have to do that.
It's the trial judges. The trial judges don't want to do that.
Right, but they would only have to do that if the appellate court agreed that this looks like one of those out-of-whack sentences, right? So the norm wouldn't be, you have to explain in every case consecutive sentences, the norm wouldn't be you have some extra duty of explanation across the board. It's that the appellate courts would be looking to, wow, this really feels like an outlier to us. Again, if we had data, they could actually say, this is an outlier to us. And it's in those cases, again, it's not, we think you got it wrong, it's, we want to see a greater explanation on the record for why this application of consecutive sentences that leads to this long a sentence makes sense. Now again, that may not function well, that may be back to the, sort of pre-Foster trouble, but I would, the way it's played out in the federal system seems to be as sort of viable a balance these days as you get, although still lots of appellate judges and district judges would likely complain that the system is not worth the candle. So,
well, it could work, and what you're suggesting seems to me could work in conjunction with a cap on the number of consecutive sentences, that if they want to exceed whatever cap is appropriate, they have to write an essay and do what Judge Salvaggio is already doing, okay?
Yeah.
That would be the idea,
sure.
I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right.
What do you think the trial judges would say about that?
I like the idea of a cap, and
look, so
when I surveyed some judges around the state, this, in light of Senate Bill 201 and indefinite sentencing, let me give you just a 2 second or 1 minute example. Let's say you cap consecutive sentencing at the two most serious offenses. So let's say you have two F1s, and we know in Ohio 11, now the 16 and a half technically would be the range. But you get 11 years and 11 years, that's 22 years. If you made that tail 100%, ODRC could then, you wouldn't be sentencing somebody to more than 22 actual years, but they could hold them up to 44 if the guy was a really, really bad actor. And that, when you think about somebody in their 20s who commits a crime like this, they're going to be held well into their 40s and potentially into their 60s, but at least they're not getting 138 years as inheritance. So, I mean, that's one example of how it could be made to work. The judges would still have full discretion to sentence within the ranges. They wouldn't have to give reasons. That would be presumptively, I think, proportional because it falls within a range that the legislature has established. That's one way of doing it. There are other ways, like Judge Rice, you mentioned, going back to the pre-Foster.
Pre-Foster, the problem with that was we had the presumption of the minimum, the presumption of non-prison. That is what made our sentencing structure
violative of Blakely and Apprendi. If you don't have those presumptions that hold a judge back, just this is the sentencing range, then a factual finding that they make is for sentencing purposes that the feds have said is okay. That's a judicial function. It's not a fact-finding that should be done by the jury. Then it's more reviewable. I mean, it's not contrary to federal law.
Yes.
To get you where you need to be for this organization, the judicial conference is set up to circulate things like this. So our appellate law committee that Josh Williams staffs will be looking at this, and our goal will be to recommend something soon. You can all look at that. We'll be vetting it in the meantime with Representative Sykes and his counterparts in the Senate. As I told Judge Gallagher, my initial take after this case came out was some formula of caps, either absolute or caps that establish a presumption. So if you go above it, then up to the trial judge whether or not they want to explain themselves, but there's a presumption that it's excessive after you go above the cap. So what's the formula? That would be something that's debated and will change in the legislative process and other approaches. I wouldn't look at Hairston as that meaningful. The court's changed. Secondly, what wasn't discussed in Hairston is these bad boys who were doing the home invasions in German Village and making people strip down to naked and while they robbed them and had them all believe they were going to be murdered before they left. What isn't in the opinion is they also went down to Souda County and committed a murder. So when the court considered that, we weren't really that worried about that being excessive because they were going to stay in prison anyway because of the Souda County murder. So it really was just focused on the Eighth Amendment and what the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence there was. And on Foster, the court was assuming one thing in terms of where the U.S. Supreme Court was going, and then they came out with Oregon versus Heights afterwards. So that case might not have been decided the same way had Oregon versus Heights been out there. So there are a lot of nuances in all of this. I think what our goal will be is to soon, when do you next meet? When does this organization meet?
March.
Certainly before then, we will have resolved with Judge Gallagher will be very much involved in that, and all of the appellate judges will be. We'll have resolved some recommendation to the legislature.
Justice Pfeiffer, as you know, we have a meeting next week with our appellate review committee. Josh has already sent out some stuff on it, so if the commission wants us, we can put a package together of give them
options.
We'll be willing to do that.
Yeah. So, our goal is to get something done soon that starts the music. Something that the legislature can start with, and this group can weigh in on it. But right now it's sort of an academic discussion. It needs to be brought down to something.
Does the victim have a constitutional right to participate in the appellate review process of a sentence, to brief the issues from the victim standpoint?
That's a great question, and it's another area that 295308, I think, is flat out wrong, given Marcy's law, because I think, I don't know how we appellate judges think we can sentence from the appellate bench and afford a victim the right to be present, or even the defendant has a right of allocution. Even if he's getting a benefit at the appellate level, he should still have a right to speak. And I think that's just that 2953L passage that says we can, what is it, modify, reverse, or that's a bad practice. And I've sent it to Representative Boggs, my comments about her proposed changes to 201, and you know, we could get rid of that. And but we can offer some fundamental, I think,
fixes. Representative Cupp is working with interested parties on all of that. And that includes what's going to happen at the appellate level with the victims. And right now it looks like the thought is they would have to file an original action to have any standing. They're not a party, so they don't have a place at the table in the appellate court. But though that legislation hadn't even been introduced.
Where do you want to be at?
I think our you know, we're going to have to do something because the population is going to go up. I don't think there's any way to say it's not going to go up. It is going to go up. So I think we have to start next week, and we can start putting something together with Josh and our group of appellate judges and work with whoever you tell us to work with, and we'll put something together. We've been working on this for years. We have.
So you'll report back to us in March?
Sure, we'll report back to you way before March.
Yeah, but I would hope, Justice Pfeiffer, that the appellate committee tunes into the Common Pleas Committee, yes. Too. So we don't need them coming out with recommendations. And
we won't.
A month later, the Common Pleas Committee says, well, we think they're all that. We don't.
I value my hide, Senator Seitz. I value my hide, so I'll try and pass it.
Yeah. We had the ability to electronically circulate to all the interested judicial parties. And we share with the prosecutors so they can see what's coming.
Senator Thomas?
And my concern is numbers going up. That's really just out. We have close to 50,000 or something.
Inevitable consequence of Reagan Tokes and all the other sentencing enhancement bills that have been passed.
Well, if you think about it, there's no real review right now.
You guys can fix that. If you want the numbers to go down, you guys can fix it.
But if, you know, it was 11 years, now it's 11 to 16 and a half under Reagan Tokes.
I understand.
If you do the math, it's...
This might be a good segue then to, in the last couple minutes we have, Scott is going to give some update on Senate Bill 3, and we can elicit a couple of comments. Governor's working group will be emailed to you.
So yesterday at the Senate Judiciary hearing, the substitute Senate Bill 3 was amended a number of times, and I did over here at the meeting materials, there is a list of those things, but I just wanted to go through stuff for folks just so we stay fully aware. This is for everybody. The drug reform bill, sponsored by Senator Eklund, that's been pending. I think that was its ninth hearing, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday. So the first amendment was 1472. Senator Gaborone has Senate Bill 55 pending, which is an enhancement to trafficking charges for trafficking in the vicinity of an addiction services provider. That bill is awaiting a House floor vote currently, and Senate Bill 3 was amended to include the provisions of that trafficking enhancement. The second was was Amendment 1473. Judge Spanagel submitted to Senator Eklund and the other sponsors of Senate Bill 3 a list of suggested changes that were, from his perspective as a municipal court judge, one of which was the bill didn't address what an attempted unclassified misdemeanor would look like. So traditionally, an attempt is one degree lower than the offense that it would be, and an attempted M1 is an M2. But there was nothing in there that said what an attempted unclassified misdemeanor would be. There was a provision added to the attempt statute specifically, that's 29-2302. making it a misdemeanor of the first degree. So if you have one of these new unclassified misdemeanor possession offenses and the prosecutor pleads it to an attempt or charges it as an attempt, that would be a misdemeanor of the first degree. But it does add a caveat that the sentencing judge would have available to them any sort of sentencing alternative that would have been available for that unclassified misdemeanor possession charge. The next one was 1474, which was probably the most substantive change, I think, of all the amendments. It dealt with the jurisdictional provisions of the bill and said, basically mandated that an unclassified misdemeanor possession offense be charged initially in a municipal or county court and allow either the court, the prosecutor of the, or the defendant to move to have that transferred to common police court. Any one of those three could do it, and the court had discretion as to whether to do it or not. That language is mirrored. The language is on that sheet that's over there if you didn't get a copy or there, but it allows discretion to the municipal court to determine that transfer.
Can I just make a comment? I have a concern for our friends in the legislature. I believe this amendment, as proposed, will result in form shopping within the specific communities, particularly in communities that have APA services. There are 18 counties. When a case is placed on misdemeanor supervision in an APA county, that's considered monitored time, which means that the person does not report to their probation officer, which means that the APA has to review their status once every year. And so if, number one, if we allow a defendant, well, if we allow any party singularly to switch courts, depending on the jurisdiction you're gonna have, that's gonna cause a problem with foreign shopping. And then number two, for counties that have APA supervision, they're not gonna be supervised. So I'm concerned with this amendment.
The next one's a little bit confusing, and it alters the definition of what the bill calls a sexual assault enabling drug to specifically remove clonazepam, but then it adds a provision that if someone legally is in possession of a drug, but their intended use for it is something other than what the drug is intended for, they can be charged with possession of a sexual assault enabling drug. That was the change to that definition. 1477 just added a provision saying that a charge or conviction for an unclassified misdemeanor possession offense would still disable someone from owning a firearm and allow them to be charged under the Weapons of Disability section. 1478 and 1500 were both, but 1478 dealt with speedy trial time and said these unclassified misdemeanors will be subject to felony speedy trial, so 270 days. 90 days if they're in jail, and 1500 was the statute of limits. The felony statute of limitations will apply to the unclassified misdemeanor possession offenses. 1501 dealt with forfeiture issues surrounding these unclassified misdemeanor possession offenses and treats the records. There's some reclassification, and those reclassifications will be treated as felonies for forfeiture purposes. And then finally, 1479 was a change to the proposed definition of technical violation for 29, 29, 15B purposes, and basically said that a demonstrated refusal to participate in community control is not a technical violation. So somebody who just refuses from the outset and demonstrates they're not going to participate in the conditions of community control is not a technical violator for those purposes. If anybody has questions or would like those amendments sent to them specifically, I'm happy to do that. Just reach out to me.
Okay.
Yep. Coming right now, Sam.
Any other comments, questions? Okay, the governor's panel information will be sent to you, I believe, by email. So can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.